Well, here it is, folks. All you ever wanted to know about the end of the movie. To unpack its mysteries, I'm joined on the line from Paris by John Baxter, author of the latest Kubrick biography, Jane Mills, lecturer in screen studies at the Australian Film, Television and Radio School, and American science fiction author, now resident in Melbourne, Jack Nann. Let's begin with the musical vision. John Baxter, how about the idea of an overarching musical structure and the rejection of North's score for Kubrick's own choices, not only Zarathustra, but Ligeti's ethereal but very dark-toned Lux Aeterna to signify the monolith or sentinel?
Well, yes, there are many ways in which, the whole of 2001 aspires to the condition of music, but it wasn't always that way. The original, as Arthur Clarke wrote it, was very wordy and allowed very little space for music. It opened, for instance, with an elaborate series of interviews with experts on xenobiology and religion and so on. It was only towards the end when Kubrick, really in the last months of editing, threw out every bit of Clarke's logical development and went back to simple images that he realized that it was very hard to hold the whole thing together unless there was a sort of additional structure, some kind of logic. And I think it's at that point that he began to think about it being essentially, as you say, a suite in three movements illustrating certain ideas about good and evil, the future, the past, the nature of man, and so on. And at that point, his Manichaeanism kicked in, his belief in the real existence of evil as an alternative to good, and that the two are warring in the universe. And I think that's probably why he threw out Alex North's rather elegant, but I think somewhat deficient symphonic score, and elected for music which he could more precisely tune to those ideas.
Jane, does the movie introduced by way of music metaphysical dimensions?
Yes, I think it does. I think it certainly raises the questions. Very interesting that you're talking about the music, the symphony, meaning that we don't have a linear narrative, because at the same time it almost points up a linear narrative, a sense of evolution, I mean, from the apes, and man evolves. But then the question mark, you know, is man evolving in this linear way in the right way? Is there something that's sort of programmed into humankind that prevents it? So it's like he's saying there is a meta-narrative, actually, here. There is a linear narrative, but is it working? So it raises that question, and the juxtaposition between something that is non-linear with something that is perhaps trying to be linear, I find very interesting.
What is the meaning of the sentinel at the opening, Jack?
Well, I'm looking at this from the perspective of 99. I mean, I see the sentinel as us. I don't know if Kubrick was doing this. I mean, he has in other films, combining the God and man, evil, etc. But I see what humankind is doing with Hal in the film is what the Sentinel has done to us.
I see it as the symbol of actually our curiosity and of our need for knowledge. And that we open it up and we might find good or bad. No, actually, not might be either or, it'll be both.
John?
Yes, I think Jane is right. I mean, well, right. There are no right and wrong in this, but originally, what the apes saw inside the black monolith were films, which sort of illustrated the points that was being made about pure technology. You know, bang the stones together, guys. And he refined that by turning it into the absolutely featureless monolith. But I think we're meant to believe that this is knowledge in the abstract. This is knowledge.
This is pure knowledge.
Contains its threat, contains as much of a threat as a promise, and that it was down to man to decide what to do with it, and he elected to turn a simple tool into a weapon, and then as Moonwatcher flings it into the air, it's transformed from a killing bone into an orbiting atomic weapon which rings Earth, and we're meant to show that man has taken, I think, at least one wrong road on that voyage away from knowledge.
John Baxter, is this a parable about good and evil? And is the sequence of the dawn of man, where the apes find knowledge, confront the sentinel, the opening of a parable?
Yes, I think in a way all of Kubrick's movies are parables about good and evil, because this was certainly a very early preoccupation of his. You know, he's making the point, I think, that that really all battles, all wars are essentially fought between two halves of ourselves. And so by the time he got to 2001, which I regard as his most mature film, he had find this conviction down, and working with Clarke certainly helped him to find a framework for it. So yes, in many ways it is a parable, and the music certainly reinforces that, I think.
Joe?
I couldn't agree more. That the fact that Kubrick, all his films have got this very Manichaean sense of good and evil coexisting at the same time. Sometimes it almost feels incredibly obvious. If you think of Full Metal Jacket, when you've got the character with painted on his hat, Born to Kill, and on his lapel he's got an anti-war badge. It almost sounds trite, but somehow he always gets away with it. It never is trite. You can see that the good and evil in Humbert Humbert as well. It's a very extreme case of good and evil and sort of sexual perversion going on. But he understands that what was a medieval heresy, that need to explore in humankind the coexistence of good and evil, and he does do it superbly. It's very strong, obviously, also in the Hal character.
Jack, your response to that?
Yes, well, he certainly did an interesting job of that with The Clockwork Orange, where he gives you a character that, against all of your better judgment, you can't help but like, who actually is evil until society takes away gives him a lobotomy and takes away his soul.
It does strike me that in 2001, and possibly every other one of his films, that he is questioning the project of the Enlightenment. Is that working? Is that a working proposition? Does a linear narrative and a meta-narrative and a sense of progress and empiricism and all those things, i.e. intensely humanistic, approach, is that really going to work? I mean, that seems to me the big question that he's always asking.
The theme of the meaning of intelligence is developed very precisely by Kubrick with Hal, and we are taken to the moment very carefully where Hal says no.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Hal? Hal? Hal?
Do we, in transferring artificial intelligence to a computer, in giving it the power of choice, also give it the knowledge of good and evil and the power to do evil?
It actually was, for me, bringing up the whole image of Pandora and the role that curiosity plays in the human project. I mean, without curiosity, I think we are dead. We are empty, absolutely empty vessels. We are just sort of like objects for the gods to play with. We need that curiosity. Of course, the thing about curiosity or about Pandora is that when she opens her box and all the evils of the world come out, so too does hope. So hope is around there, and I think that Kubrick was very aware of the harm or the damage or the harm and damage that perhaps hope can do to humankind, but that without it, we're not human.
I think probably closer to the truth is the fact that Kubrick, while he loved machines and adulated them and thought them in many ways superior to man, he retained, as Jane says, a sense that somehow there was a sin there. There was an essential evil that lurked in even an artificial intelligence, just as it lurks in that of man, and that evil was embodied somewhere within the memory of Hal. And it's interesting when Bowman cuts off the higher functions, he's reduced to the level of a child singing Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. And you know, you begin to realize that is the childish innocence that is the other the face of the evil that kills the other astronauts.
There's something else going on here, isn't there, about the role that feeling plays? I mean, obviously for Hal, feeling is hugely problematic. He's programmed to feel at some level, but when he's cracking up, that's what he keeps repeating over and over again. You know, I am feeling. That is very difficult.
He says, I am afraid.
And he then says, I am afraid. You've got in Humbert, too, a sort of lack of sensitivity and sensibility for actually how a pubescent girl would be feeling. I mean, he's incapable of being a rounded human being and of seeing what somebody else might be feeling. The droogs, of course, I mean, that whole area there, they can rape someone, they can cause havoc, and they're not quite human. Because they are machine-like in some way. They haven't got feeling. I mean, I find it very interesting that to go back to Hal, because I do think he is the most interesting character in the whole film.
Something that you said earlier on actually resonates with the other great unmade project of Kubrick's, which is AI, for artificial intelligence, which was the work he'd been working on for the last 10 years on and off with various people like Brian Aldiss and Bob Shaw and Sarah Maitland. This is was to be a futuristic version of Pinocchio, where the Pinocchio character, instead of being a wooden doll, was a robot who was looking to become human. It very much resonates with what you were saying about that vision of how the idea of innocence and decadence of good and evil of corruption and simplicity existing within the same creature. The idea that we should aspire, if we're a machine, we should aspire to humanity, but then we may not like what we have become.
And innocent, or the worm in the bud being knowledge.
Yes, I think so. I think that's very, very much Kubrick's preoccupation, and one, you know, if you wanted to indulge in some cheap psychoanalysis, then we could go back to his own very indifferent education and the fact that he really dragged himself out of the American educational system by becoming expert with a camera, and thus finding a job. Though perhaps I'm being over cruel to the American education system. I don't know how Jack feels about it.
Probably not. Well. Something that Jane had said, and this is going back, but it seemed to me that the most emotional scene in the film was really the death of Hal. We watched the death of a computer, and that seems to be what resonates with us. So I thought it was interesting, the idea of emotion and artificial intelligence, because that's some of the only real emotion in the film.
Yes, and in this brief bit of the discussion, we've actually been begging the question of man in creating Hal is doing what the Sentinel did in bestowing the knowledge of good and evil on the pre-man.
We're probably getting very close to that actually coming to be, and that we might well be giving birth to a new species, i.e. artificial intelligence, and I think it will be difficult to extrapolate what that might be, because it will not necessarily act as we do.
Clark was preoccupied with this, but in the end put it aside. And I think Kubrick did the same thing. You know, film is not that precise a tool for analyzing such things. I think we're waiting for the filmmaker who can complete the lesson that Kubrick began with 2001.
I'm not sure I am waiting for that moment, because what I like about film so much is precisely that it's not precise. That we are talking, or film is talking about metaphor. It is a vague.
And 2001 is particularly open-ended in that
absolutely.
Sense.
Absolutely. And it also constantly, I mean, especially Kubrick's films, I constantly feel that he is accrediting me, a member of the audience, with my own intelligence to work out my own feelings. And I look at his films and I can see almost on paper, if you like, in script form, something that might be very, very pessimistic. I actually come out of his films, Full Metal Jacket, for instance, which is at the end is a disaster. It is horrible. What it's saying about humankind, you could take to say very concretely, is bad news for human beings. But actually, I come out of that film and rest of Kubrick's films, Clockwork Orange 2, feeling intensely optimistic that his belief or my belief is reaffirmed that we get things wrong and we keep going, like that
but
revolution is possible there. We are dealing with it, exactly.
To this last section of the film, the section which people say, tell me what it means. John, you mentioned Hal and that unblinking eye. The common thread in the transition through all those wonderful psychedelic effects is that the camera moves ever closer to Bowman's eye, and eventually, in its solarized form, it looks very much like the unblinking eye of Hal, except this one keeps blinking. Is he saying something about this being as much an interior experience as it is an external one that Bowman's experiencing here?
Yes, very much so. I think we're to take the last third as being very, very largely subjective. Kubrick is very much a solipsist. If you can't see it, it doesn't exist. And I believe that that's what he was pushing on to say, that the real next leap is a leap of perception, a leap of understanding. Though he returns to the star child at the end, that's very much a Clark image, the reborn child, and so on. And in a way, I think rather perfunctory conclusion to the film. The real message is in those curious scenes where the younger Bowman sees the older Bowman standing in the 18th century interiors with their 21st century decor, a whole sort of melange of different visions of history, different visions of youth and age. It's really a thing of the mind. It's really it's an intellectual conceit, probably as close to a pure intellectual conceit as Kubrick ever got, and it relates back probably to some of the things said in the other movies. In Full Metal Jacket, quizzed by the general why he has a peace symbol and a death symbol at the same time, he says, "Well, I want to say something about it's Jungian, sir. It's something about the dichotomy of man." I think that probably comes close to what Kubrick is playing with in the end of the film.
So he takes us to a notion of the soul. I mean, mankind can join the stars, can be one of the stars. It's Kubrick moving on from a phenomenological approach where with all its connotations of property and empiricism and, testing everything, and he does seem to me to get then towards a metaphysical approach.
Yeah, I was listening to what John said. I think that you're right. The star child at the end of the sequence doesn't quite fit. It's so obviously a symbol where the kind of 20 minutes of non-linear stuff that we see before that almost feels like a transcendent, intensely personal experience, which prefunctorily ends with the symbol of rebirth. But the stuff that was happening before was not symbolic in that sense. It just felt very 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 personal. And to me, it's one of the best imaginings of transcendence that I think that I've seen on the screen.
He is also alluding to where physics has taken us, isn't he? He's actually saying that we're into the realm of aesthetics here, just as modern physics can only ultimately express itself in terms of particles such as beauty, charm, whatever.
Well, I think there's the idea behind that is that he's used all of this coal technology to bring on this kind of personal transcendence, which I may be out of the room here, but that was the way that I interpreted what I saw on the screen. That might not be what he thought he was doing.
Did that mean you felt removed from it? You were seeing somebody else's transcendence? I mean, I felt that I was seeing mine as well, actually. I was right in there. It wasn't a sort of personal vision or a solipsistic view, necessarily. I mean, I was there being reborn myself.
Maybe yes. It depends on what you were smoking.
Yeah, I think the odd thing about this film, John had mentioned before, the idea of putting ideas on the screen, science fictional ideas. I think that 2001 actually somehow did this. It really is a film of ideas which somehow feels profound, and yet it's all visual.
We've all said that last image deals with transcendence. In this transcendence, is Kubrick being optimistic and saying ultimately we can escape who and what we are, or is there any hint that in this transcendence we will carry the evil with us? He actually seems to be saying, no, at a point we can escape the evil. John?
No, I don't think you can. I don't think Kubrick ever felt you could escape the evil. I think he always felt that we would carry the essential problems of our ape nature into another dimension. And, you know, Full Metal Jacket, it's not a weapon, he says. It's the hard heart that kills. And he believed that the hard heart was eternal, I believe. I tend to agree with Jack that really the ending of 2001 is inappropriate to the last third of the movie. The problem is, how else do you end this? You know, there are some things which you can't really top. And after that that final plunge through the infinite and the scenes in the whatever it is we're looking at, the inside of Bowman's mind, perhaps, it's very hard to then switch back to another to a finish, unless you're going to bring on the jugglers or the clowns or a big musical number.
But he brings back Nietzsche.
Well, he brings back Nietzsche, and he brings back Arthur Clarke.
Yes.
Of course, that's Clarke's skill, the quotidian. You know, Clarke turns the end of the sock very effectively. He's a narrative writer, and he brought that back. But in a sense, I don't believe that the film has a real ending. It's unendable.
Because mankind hasn't ended, has it? Where I would disagree with you there, John, is that I don't think Kubrick is ever saying that we've got part ape nature. He's saying this is human nature, and this is what it is to be human. It is to contain those seeds of good and bad, evil, sin, but there's the possibility of good.
Jane Mills, John Baxter, and Jack Dunn. We'll have to let Jack Dan, rather. Thank you. We'll have to leave you there. It's all about original sin, really, isn't it? And that brings us to the end of today's program. But if you wish to catch up with us in cyberspace, we'll be on the web at www.abc.net.au/rn. And transcripts are available for $10 from Radio National Transcripts at Post Office Box 9994, Sydney 2001. I kid you not. Thanks to Lynn Gallagher.
John. I'm sorry, John. This is the end of the program.
Australia, this is Radio National.